Good morning. I'd like to call the Judiciary Committee of the Senate to order. Today's Wednesday, April the 12th, 2006. It's now 8:37 a.m. And we have Senator French, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. And first thing that we're going to do this morning is we're going to work on CS for Senate House Bill 318. And we have representative of the sponsor here. What we have done, for the record, is we have, last time we met on this bill, we did some extensive amendments, and so we asked the drafters to come out with a CS that incorporates all those amendments so that we could make sure we didn't trip over our own selves somewhere in the process, because it was extensively amended. And Craig, if you'll put yourself on the record and give us your analysis of the of how this particular CS has come out compared to how we amended it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. For the record, Mr. Speaker, I'm getting ahead of myself. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Craig Johnson. I am staff to Lisa McGuire. After reviewing this and having Peter with the Department of Law, Putzier, review this, we feel that it is accurately reflected the changes that were made in the amendments, that they were appropriately, everything is pretty much as wished, with the one exception, and that's on page 4, line 27. It said an owner must, personal residence means a structure, dwelling place of an individual that A, must be used by the owner or prior owner or beneficiary. That was supposed to be in B and not A. I think what that would do is mean if it's ever been a residence, it would not be allowed to it would be defined as a personal residence if it had ever been. So we need to remove prior owner in that case while leaving it in B down below, because we did want it in the 90-day portion to protect that transition of home ownership.
I think that's probably correct. I don't remember that we did amend. We just amended B, if I'm correct.
That's our understanding as well. And that would be the only change that we would see in the CS, different than what your wishes were.
Okay. Chair would entertain a motion to adopt this CS.
Mr. Chair, I move that CS for CS House Bill 318 be adopted.
Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Chair would entertain a motion to strike on page 27, page 4, line 27, the words prior owner.
So moved.
Motion's been made by Senator Huggins. Is there objection? Hearing none. Amendment number 1 is adopted. I didn't see in reviewing the CS any other errors, and I didn't pick that one up. So thank you, Craig, for noticing that. Did any of the members? Okay. Thank you, Craig. We've closed public testimony on a bill before, but some folks from the Alaska Association of Realtors have asked to be able to testify, and I said, if you'll select one, looks like, Dave, you're the one, huh?
I'm the one.
So we'd be glad to have your testimony on the record. So welcome to Senator Judiciary Committee this morning, Dave. And if you'll introduce yourself to the committee, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Well, thank you,
for
Senator
the record,
Seekins.
Senator Gist has joined us.
I am Dave Feakin from Kenai. I'm representing the Alaska Association of Realtors, and I also serve on a national committee with the National Association of Realtors that has land use, property rights, and the environment, which has dealt with the Kelo case a number of times, have been in a party of meetings that included over 3 hours with the attorneys that argued the case before the Supreme Court. So we have a little bit of working knowledge of the case. Our testimony today would center around a recent amendment that was put in dealing with municipalities may exercise the power of eminent domain to acquire private property from a private person for the purpose of transferring title to the property for economic development. That's on page 6. This basically is the Kelo case. You're put back in here in reverse. understanding that there are a few issues that municipalities have to meet to do that, I would probably categorize those as minor speed bumps. When you deal with issues at a local level, especially surrounding eminent domain for economic development, you deal with growth and no growth people on a city council or borough assembly, and then you deal with the swing vote, one or two people. So how many votes do you really, really need to accomplish this? The swing vote. That's all you need. You need one or two votes. It's pretty easy for a local city council or borough assembly to justify taking a few properties for the benefit of the whole, which generally resolve around the issue of tax revenue. I think we've politically corrected that term, and we're now calling it economic development. Currently, there's only approximately 1% of the state of Alaska that's in private hands, so there's plenty of other property out there for economic development. Just doing some research online with Scott Bullock's, who was one of the attorneys that argued the case before the Supreme Court, the Florida House recently has passed unanimously a constitutional amendment dealing with eminent domain for economic development on all properties, including slums and blighted areas that are in private hands. So this is a national issue. There's legislation before the U.S. Congress that has passed the House, limiting economic development funding to communities and states that do this. It's in the Senate and it's moving. The National Association of Realtors expects that to pass within the next 6 months or so. And the reason why is there's currently 10,000 active private property takings for the purpose of economic development in this country. There's 50 states. That's 200 per state. We don't have any. So this is a national issue. Since the Kelo case, the media has gotten a hold of this. The issue is growing. It's not shrinking. It's becoming an election issue for a lot of for members of Congress and the House of Representatives. So, you know, the point of it is that bill will pass. So passing an amendment like this potentially could restrict economic development money to these areas. So 50 years from now, I would say that all of you are working on a very important issue with gas and oil development and taxes, but 50 years from now, this will be the bill that you passed this year that people will remember when they're shoving Peggy Ann and I around in our wheelchairs to get in here to testify. So thank you for the opportunity to come back and address this issue. And that's the end of my testimony.
Questions for Dave. Senator Guest.
Thank you, Dave. The bill also allows for the legislature to go around and to pass a bill to allow this, but you didn't comment on that. And one of the conversations we had here is the importance of local control. And of course, the Kelo case was a little different because they gave their authority to someone else. It wasn't an elected body who made the decision. But you know, one of the discussions we had here was if the legislature, which often isn't as public for many people and more political, can make that decision in Juneau, should we not set the bar high and allow local control? So I guess do the realtors have an opinion about the legislative language in here?
I think our discussion has been, and thank you for that, and I'm sorry I didn't comment on that. New London, Connecticut City Council delegated that authority unanimously to that group to do the job, to get the political pressure off of themselves. But then it came back and they approved what they did. So, I mean, it was just kind of a roundabout way to save face. The issue has gotten beyond the semantics of how New London, Connecticut did it, and it's private property taking for economic development. That is the issue now. In the meeting we had a couple of days ago, this body, the state legislature, is a lot more deliberate body. Things don't move near as fast. There's 60 votes here versus the one or two swing votes you need at a local level to make this sort of a decision. So we would much rather see this left at the state level.
I guess I'll tell you what my concern was about that situation is, one, I appreciate you thinking that we're more deliberative and slow. I don't know if that is always the case. And it's not the case you need 60, you need 21 and 11.
Right.
And it is the case that if you have a member from a minority district maybe the senator and the representative are both in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
They represent a small community, let's say a Cordova. It could be that is either used as political leverage one way or the other, or stopped one way or the other from what the community wants, versus a local control, which puts it into local hands. Now, will that happen? I've also seen, I mean, it's one of the reasons we have the language in here. Also, things can get put in the last minute, just like anywhere else. So although I appreciate our process down here, I don't necessarily think it is ever a better process than a local process with local public hearings where people can voice their opinions. But it's a balance. And so that's why I was wondering when you all say we don't want the local process. I think if we don't have the local process, we might maybe shouldn't have the legislative process either. Because I think both have pros and cons to them in these situations, and what we were trying to do was balance those.
Well, I think that because it's not an issue in the state of Alaska, eminent domain, private to private for economic development, really is not an issue we're dealing with like the rest of the states. If you study the states where it is an issue, they're going to that extreme. You don't do it. Nobody does it, is the issue. That's how they're dealing with the issue. So we're trying to set benchmarks in that, and I think that the Alaska Association of Realtors has represented, you know, we have realtors in every community, and a lot of us have worked this process. I mean, if it's a community that's not looking for growth, you know, big box retail or whatever that issue is, big box retail doesn't go there. But if the community that is at least there's a balance within municipal government and one or two swing votes, then you can go there, and all you need is one or two swing votes to make that decision rather than 11 or 21. So I think that's the reason why we analyzed it and decided that it's a lot better at the state level. And understanding at the end of the session some things pass, but you got to get out of one body to even get in, you know, the finals.
Actually, you just have to get an amendment on a bill that's going over to the other body. But I just want to make it clear that, honestly, I think sometimes I think it would be a toss-up on whether two-thirds at a local level would be easier than 11 and 21 in the legislature or harder. I don't think we know. I think it's all dependent on the politics and the issue of the day. So I think if there's a concern about the local control issue, I think there's a legitimate concern about the legislature.
This is a lot more public arena, though, for the issue. At the local level, this happens. There's just one going on in Kenai with the Walmart store. This all happens prior to the 90-day notice. The votes are there prior to the thing ever happening. This is a lot more public body where there's a lot more potential for debate on the issue or the whole thing to become public prior to those, you know, the Kelo case was that whole thing was put together before those 50 people had any idea what was going on. Then they couldn't organize themselves fast enough or had the money to defend themselves against what was going on. So that's what the National Association of Realtors is trying to prevent. And obviously it's going on in every state. So
great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins?
Thank you. Dave, if I might, I talked to Dave and some of his colleagues yesterday, and it reminded me, and I knew there was something bothered me about this issue, because I think when the amendment was issued, some of us made this statement that that's what got us here to begin with, and Dave said the same thing a few moments ago. And then myself in our off time was concerned about the issue and the respect that we had a two-thirds vote, and I said, how can we make this tougher if we got the local control part? And I was thinking about three-quarters. So my instincts remain the same, that it is much too slippery a slope at this point in time. That's what has got us here, and quite frankly, I would prefer that we tighten this up, and I think sending it to local control does loosen the prerogative.
So, other questions? Thank you very much, Dave, and
thank you for the opportunity.
Appreciate your being here and bringing my good friend Peg Ann McConaughey with you.
Thank you.
Just for not on the subject, but Peggy Ann's father was a Ford dealer in Spokane, Washington, who when I was just a young pup was very good to me and helped me out on a number of occasions. And how old is your dad now, Peggy Ann?
76.
76, and he still plays a mean game of golf, let me tell you. So,
I'll tell him 70.
Yeah. We did, as I said, we did close public testimony on this bill earlier. You know, in some response, we looked at some of the post-Kello versus New London legislation and got them from almost all the states that do have it. And it's very interesting for me as I went through this to look at some of the, like New York requires a local government to vote to approve the proposed use of eminent domain to commend private property for another private use. Illinois has some override factors. Michigan prohibits the transfer except for blighted or areas, et cetera. I mean, there's a whole wide range of how some of the states are looking at it. And in the end, if the federal legislation comes back and says, unless your state law complies to this, you don't get economic development funding, then I think that it'll become another issue for the legislature to take a look at. And I think this discussion will continue in the next committee of referral, I'm sure of that. And so I think that's one of those bills where probably it's going to get some more change, and it's going to get some more discussion before we get to vote on it on the floor as well. And then it'll probably go to a conference committee where it'll even get some more discussion, I'm sure, some very high-intensity discussion on this bill. But I can agree with Senator Huggins that if we're going to have local control or local overrideability, it has to be, as we said earlier, very open, very public, and a super, super majority doesn't bother me on that if we're going to retain that feature. So, because it has to be very, very tight. Okay? As I said, we closed testimony on it earlier. Are there any further proposed amendments from any of the members of the committee? Seeing none, is there a will of the committee on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that CS for House Bill 318 be moved committee with attached physical note, individual comments as amended.
Okay. Senator Huggins has moved the committee, the bill, to the next committee. Is there objection? Hearing none, it's so ordered. And this now goes to Finance Committee, where I'm sure the discussion will continue. And we'll take a short recess to take care of our paperwork. We're back on the record. Next, we have before us Senate Bill 134. Our prime sponsor is Senator Bundy. Welcome, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, Con Bundy, Senate District P.
I'd like to preface my comments. I'm sorry the realtor left, but I would hope he'd share with the Daily News that he feels ours is an open and transparent process.
Yeah.
Ms. Jerry, you have a CS before you. This bill is...
To adopt that one?
I would encourage you to do that.
Is there a motion to adopt this CS as our working document?
So moved.
Senator Huggins has moved. It's / C for Charlie.
That's correct.
And is there objection? Hearing none, that draft / C is adopted as our working document. Thank you, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to be back before you again with additional sexual assault legislation. This is a bill that's been in process for quite a while and is not as, ground zero as the previous bill you heard on sexual assault, but is one that is a companion and would be supportive of the previous bill. My office has worked closely with the Department of Law, and we crafted the changes for this CS. We also worked with Public Safety and Office of Victim Rights. To my knowledge, all the effective departments and organizations support the CS for Senate Bill 134. The problem, Mr. Chairman, is that in a state as diverse as Alaska and with a challenging investigation that has to result from sexual assault, not all victims are treated adequately, fairly, or to the high standard level of investigation that I certainly think is worthy of something as heinous as sexual assault. So what this bill does, it transfers the responsibility to handle complaints on investigations from the Alaska Police Standards Council, where they, I don't believe many investigations took place, to the Office of Victims' Rights, where, again, maybe that's the most appropriate vehicle, being it's the victim who is the one who is most likely to determine whether the investigation has been adequately handled and the case properly reviewed. This was done at the request of Public Safety because they felt OVR was an appropriate fit for representing victims in an investigation, a complaint of, about investigations. Both OVR and the Department of Law have agreed with this position. This requires the investigation complaints to be the result of either an unclassified sexual assault or an unclassified sexual abuse of a minor. Again, we don't want to clog the system with minor complaints or chronic complainers, but something that is, again, as I said, the level of an assault that our society simply cannot tolerate. This creates a pilot program that will end in September of 2008. My office began this work when we received a complaint from a sexual assault victim who could not even get her phone calls returned from the local police department. It was apparently in a botched investigation, at least in my mind, and I suppose maybe an attempt to sweep it under the rug or just ignore their scripts. As a result, I introduced this legislation. However, we don't know yet how widespread this problem is. I suppose the good news would be that this was the only time this ever happened, but I think logic suggests it's not the case, that it may indeed be a wider spread problem. Not necessarily through intentional mistakes or misconduct, but through a lack of training, a lack of equipment, maybe just through a lack of time, maybe these problems are more widespread than I hope. It's very possible they're wider spread than I hope they are, but if even one victim exists that isn't being fairly treated, it's something that we need to be aware of. This bill does have wide support in both rural and urban communities, so there's it's not just my concern. The bill allows OBR the same rights and responsibilities while handling these cases as they do with the current court cases where they are victims' advocates. In the new CS, we don't charge any organization with creating standards, even though in my heart of hearts I think we ought to have police standards and a group enforcing those standards, much like the medical board or something like that. But there isn't interest in going in that direction right now, and so I'm not creating any standards for investigations. We're allowing wide discretion for a diverse state as to what, how sex crimes ought to be investigated, depending on the professionalism of the police departments that are involved. Instead, the attorneys with OVR are charged with determining if there's been negligent in an investigation and to go about assisting the victim if there has been negligence in the investigation. OVR, Department of Law, and APD are all available to testify and answer any specific questions regarding this legislation and the impact on their department or organization. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions and encourage your positive consideration of this victim's rights supporting legislation.
Questions for the sponsor. Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Senator Bundy, why did you make the determination just to go with crimes in the first degree? A lot of times we hear that because there's a question of whether they'll get conviction, they actually, you know, charge with a lower or they'll plead things down. And so why?
Thank you, Senator Terrio, through the chair. Perhaps Department of Law will want to chat about this as well. But in my mind, you know, the charge, the plea bargaining doesn't happen until after the charge, and so this would be at the charging level. And again, the art of the possible wanted this to be focused on the most serious crimes and not to clog the system with those who might tend to be amateur lawyers or complaints that aren't of the magnitude of rape or serious child sexual abuse.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, we may have some as we go along. Senator Bundy, who did you have in mind, Department of Law, someone else that you wanted to testify on the bill?
There's both APD and Department of Law folks
okay.
here.
I do have Mr. Miller online.
And OVR folks as well.
Okay. I do have Mr. Miller online from the Anchorage Police. Is he one of them that you had set up? Mr. Miller, are you there?
Actually, it's Walt Monaghan.
Mr. Monaghan.
Bill dialed for me because I was delayed, so I apologize for the confusion.
Mr. Monaghan, welcome to Senate Judiciary this morning. If you want to introduce yourself to the committee, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony on the bill.
Okay, thank you. My name is Walt Monaghan. I'm the Anchorage Police Chief.
It probably sounds better if I pick up the little handset here.
There you
go. I apologize. what I want to do is voice my support for this. Sexual assault is a major problem, not only in Anchorage, but across the state. And I think the only way we're going to be able to tackle this effectively is through legislation that has already been passed, because I think that's an excellent tool for us. But now that we have tools, we have to have the ability to use them. And what we want to do is heighten the level of professionalism in our investigations of major crimes like this. And I'm not going to try to tell any other department how to do their job, but there's an expectation that we should uniformly try to do the best job that we possibly can. That's the expectation from the communities that we serve and from each other. And I think that what Senator Bundy is proposing is an excellent opportunity, kind of a watchdog. It gives victims the ability to know that where they go if they feel that they've got a less than adequate investigation and have it addressed. We all make mistakes. We all get lazy at times. And but we're always and should always be accountable. And I think that this is it's a big red spotlight that goes right on our performance, and it needs to be. And so that's, in essence, I support the bill, and I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for Mr. Monaghan. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Chief Monaghan. It's Hollis French here in Juneau. And I have a question for you, and I guess I share Senator Bundy's concern that there may be more of these cases out there than most of us are aware of. And I guess that concern sort of merges into a concern that we don't vastly increase the jurisdiction of OVR without some attendant increase in resources. And so I guess, and because this law is going to have statewide application, but because I've got you on the line, I'm going to ask you if you know or if you can tell us how many cases might fall into this place where a sex assault has been investigated, but there's never been a charge to bring it before the district attorney's office, or I guess more appropriately, where the district attorney's office has declined to press charges. And we have, you know, a dissatisfied victim or a victim who's sure that his or her case has not been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. That's the person I see going to OVR and asking that they look over the case. So is there some way for you to give us a feel for how many of those there might be, cases where your detectives take a statement, do some investigation, and forward those charges to the DA's office, and then the case is either not charged or goes into something of a limbo file?
Well, if you recall when we did our 60-day management report, we ended up disclosing to the that we had about 25% that we could do nothing with. I mean, there was a report that happened. The victim would come in and say, about 2 months ago, I went to a party. I don't remember anything, but I think this happened, and I've been thinking, dwelling on it, but finally, I need to report it. And they don't remember any names, they don't remember any addresses, and it just really gives us little to go. And the problem that we have here is that in the cases that we have so many cases that actually have good, hard information to follow up on, that the ones that have maybe one or two small leads have a tendency to be put on a back burner. And those back burner ones are the ones saying, well, you should have followed up. I mean, I know a guy that was at the party, his name was Joe, and Joe works on base somewhere. And, well, not a lot to go on, but we don't do any follow-up until we find out a little bit more. I suspect if you were to look at percentages, those would be the ones that would probably end up going to OVR saying, well, you know, the APD didn't do this or APD didn't do that. But that's a small but that's a small percentage over all the cases that are ever reported. So if you're looking for a number, I would probably have to guess statewide, maybe no more than 100 or 150 a year, and that's just an educated guess.
Thank you, Chief Monaghan. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and Senator French, one, OVR will have the discretion to decide if there's absolutely no, I mean, if it's the case that the Chief just described where it's not a lack of professionalism on the department's part. It's just a lack of information, and they don't have discretion, and they're here to testify as far as the fiscal impact on their organization, and I've been led to believe that it'll be minimal. As long as I have the floor, if I might, I just wanted to, for myself, compliment the Chief on the attitude of accountability. We shouldn't, I suppose, have higher demands of our police officers than we have of individual citizens, but we do. And the notion that someone in the field of law enforcement is eager and interested in accountability is just, for me personally, very refreshing. When we hear less interest in accountability in other areas, so I I greatly appreciate that. And his point that, again, as a state of Alaska's diversity, is if someone from rural areas have every right when they go to Anchorage to have an expectation of a level of professionalism, vice versa, certainly when people in the legislature come to Juneau, they should have the expectation of a professional response to a crime and an appropriate investigation. And if that doesn't happen, then I think the victim gets re-victimized by not having a channel to go through to have a both an advocate and a non-involved party to be able to say, well, you know, everything was done that could have been done, or no, there were some other things that should have been done, and it can be a learning experience from both sides.
Go ahead, Senator French.
Thank you. And Senator Bundy, this is a great idea. I think it's, you know, worthwhile to have another set of eyes looking at these cases, and if it just results in one case a year being brought to justice, then we've all done the world a favor. So I totally appreciate the bill. I have a question about the selection of the effective date on page 2, line 27. It strikes me that you're sort of trying to limit the scope of the universe of cases that this might apply to by saying that the offense had to have been committed on or after July 10, 2003. I'm just curious about the selection of that date.
Yeah. I'd like to ask Mr. Guarnelli to comment on that. My thoughts are that the older these cases get, the more difficult it is to accurately review them. We can ask him to comment as well.
I'll follow up with him. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for the sponsor or for Mr. Monaghan? Thank you, by the way, Mr. Chief Monaghan, for your testimony this morning.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the kind words, Senator Bundy.
Let's move to who you have next for us there, Senator. I have, just before you do, the new CS that we look at, could you just briefly summarize for us what changes you made in the new CS? I mean, the bill as it originally started out had some other provisions in there that...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the bill, the CS is a vastly different vehicle than the original bill. The original bill, we had the idea that the Police Standard Council would establish standards for investigation and then become the enforcement agency of those standards, that there would be basically universal standards across the state. As Chief Monaghan said, you know, he didn't want to tell another department how to run their department, and probably he doesn't want to be told either. Anyway, that did not seem to be workable. The law enforcement agencies, frankly, had a difficult time with the concept. Everything we do here is a work of in progress and a matter of compromise, and I was more interested in achieving something that will work rather than getting my way. So that's the, I suppose, the route to the CS.
And Mr. Senator Bundy, then, so the fiscal notes that were from March 17th, have all been replaced with the two fiscal notes dated April 11th. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
So the others that we had in our file are basically all...
That was a different version of reality.
Just for the record, I wanted to make sure that was the case. That's all I have for questions I have at the moment. We're ready for your next witness, Senator.
If I might, my next witness would be... Lauren, to fill in any gaps I left.
Welcome, Lauren. If you'll introduce yourself to the committee, we're eager to hear the gaps that you need to have filled in.
For the record, my name is Lauren Rice. I'm staff to Senator Bundy. It's actually a gap that I did. In talking to Dean Guarnelli with the Department of Law, he did suggest that we change the effective date. So victims could bring cases to OVR that committed that were committed before July 10th. Oh, it's July 10th, 2003. We did make that change.
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't reading that right. Right, ask Dean, sorry.
Thank you very much.
We'll go back to shopping at the Gap.
Who's next? Good morning and welcome to Judiciary Committee.
Good morning.
And if you'll introduce yourself for our record this morning, we're eager to hear your testimony.
All right. Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Ann Henry. I'm the newly appointed director for the Office of Victims' Rights. And I have had quite a discussion about this bill with Lauren, and there's a couple of things that I support the bill, frankly. There's a couple of concerns that I have. The first is that although at line, at lines 12 and 13 on the first page, they're talking about timely or completely investigated, but then it starts referring to justice agencies. And I'm assuming the purpose of this bill is for us to investigate timely investigations, timely and complete investigations. We're already working with justice agencies once a case has been filed. So I'm not sure why it starts with investigative agencies and then jumps to justice agencies, but that's just a minor comment. The major concern I have with the bill is that I don't think we're going to get the information that you seek. The reason is that it is still limited to us only investigating and keeping statistics on complaints from a victim. And that leaves a lot of sexual assaults that we're going to miss. Because a lot of victims don't complain to the Office of Victims' Rights. I'm assuming that the case that Senator Bundy used to propose this bill, that victim did not go to the Office of Victims' Rights. So we never would have heard about that case. I also have a case here. I've only been working for 5 weeks, but I've seen two cases where the victim did not come to Office of Victims' Rights until it was way too late. In this particular case, the victim testified in trial against her stepfather, and while she was testifying, she also admitted that her stepbrothers had been abusing her as well. The district attorney asked the investigating agency to investigate that for new crimes. She waited until she was an adult and then called the troopers and wanted to know what happened. And frankly, the troopers admitted that they had dropped the ball. And so it only came to our agency once she went to the troopers, and it was a whole new line of troopers. The troopers that originally investigated it were now retired. And so the new trooper told her to come to us, and there was nothing we could do. Another case did come to us because they were concerned about the length of the investigation, and I called the investigating agency to find out what the problem was, and as it turned out, they hadn't sent a sample of the suspect's DNA for a comparison to the lab. And I called the lab, and the lab says, well, we're just waiting. And I said, well, didn't you tell them that you needed a sample? And they said, no, we were just waiting for them to send something. So that is the kind of situation that would work for us, because the victim did contact us. So at any rate, I feel that if we're only limited to complaints from a victim of sexual assault, we're not going to get the ones that I think you really want. Frankly, once a victim has reported it and it goes by months, a lot of times the victims just give up. And they don't report, or they don't push it. Or, frankly, they're happy that it's gone away, because after 6 months, they've closed, it's closure for them. They don't want to have to remember it again, and so they're not going to complain. Those are the cases we're going to miss. And Lauren and I had a large discussion yesterday about what we can do about that. And the only thing I could come up with is a requirement that all law enforcement agencies fax us the cover sheet when they take a rape complaint. That way, it's just the information about the suspect and the victim. And that's all they have to fax us. They don't have to fax us a lot of reports or anything like that. At least then we have that information, and we can put it in our spreadsheet or whatever we're going to create, and then follow up with it later, like, say, a month later, see what's going on. And that way we do get all of the statistics. Now, the question is, how can we enforce this? And basically, what we'll have to do is just match statistics. Say Bethel had 150 rape complaints last year, and we only are getting 15 reports this year. There's obviously something wrong. We could also go to the local rape crisis clinics and make sure that we're getting all of the rape complaints, that are the complaints that are going to the investigative agencies. The problem with that, of course, is that my jurisdiction is limited in that I can only investigate when a victim complains. And so if we go the route of us requiring law enforcement to give us this information, we're going to have to change part of the section of the bill, the law on the Office of Victims' Rights to include jurisdiction solely for investigations of unclassified sexual assault and sexual abuse of a minor cases, where we get the police report from the investigative agencies rather than a complaint from the victim. So that's basically my only concern, is that we are going to lose a lot of these cases. We're never going to hear about them, and that's not going to meet the concern of the committee or Senator Bundy. All right, that's all I have. Thank you.
Questions? Senator French.
Thank you, and good morning, Marianne. The first note I wrote down on my pad was, you know, how are we going to spread the word? How are we going to let folks know that this is an avenue that's open to you? And I'm deeply impressed that you would consider reviewing or even making into a database all the reported sex assaults, first-degree sex assaults in the state. But it sounds like you need other legislation to amend your mandate to let you do that.
Yes.
So maybe that's something we just have to do at a separate time. But that strikes me as being very labor-intensive, and I commend you for being willing to take that on. I guess getting back to maybe what's achievable within the context of this bill, I guess I envision a fairly close relationship between you and APD, and at least letting them sort of sit down with you on a quarterly basis and say, these are the cases we just can't do anything with. Mm-hmm. The victim's unhappy, you know, they've complained to the DA's office, and I'm sure you'll hear about those as well. And so I think, you know, by a regular communication sort of triangle between you and the DA's and the APD, you can at least review to your satisfaction the cases that are not getting charged, and sort of look at those, and using your judgment as a longtime prosecutor, maybe you'll be able to sort of pick out those that look like a little bit of work would have been able to, you know, put together a prosecutable case. That's, I guess, just my thinking out loud about how you spread the word and how you make this into something that, you know, results in prosecutions.
Yes, and that's, you know, that's quite possible. Additionally, the investigator that I have is a retired state trooper, and so he has a lot of contacts with the troopers, so we could also do the same thing with the troopers. It's the problem is the other local police agencies that are going to fall through the cracks, and you're right. When I do this report in 2008, you know, I'll be able to say, you know, this percentage weren't prosecuted because there was lack of evidence. And you're right, I've got enough experience in that area, not as much in sexual assault as other types of cases, but I have enough experience. And I've actually worked with the sexual assault unit at the Anchorage DA's office on this a little bit as well, so I'm familiar with that.
Go ahead, Senator French.
There are numerous statutory references in the bill, and I confess I didn't hunt everyone down. I take it this bill would give you the authority to review police reports, review tapes, review evidence that was gathered by APD, and would give you something, some sort of power, if you will, to request those and expect to get them.
Yes.
Okay. And finally, your view of the effective date, it strikes me that with the increased availability of DNA testing, that may be the one thing that you can sort of force, if you will, is some testing of old cold cases that may result in a prosecution. Are you just trying to limit, have you been involved in that discussion? Are you trying to limit the universe of cases, or?
I wasn't involved in that discussion at all. First time I noticed it was this morning. I don't know why they picked that date.
I'll hold it.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Ann, congratulations. Glad to have you in your new leadership capacity.
Thank you.
You have a statewide role, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm assuming, Senator French was talking about Anchorage. I'm assuming that that's the easy part of your job.
Yes.
That you can walk down the street, you can go for a hike and go to the police department and some of the retention facilities there. But when it comes to Nome, Kotzebue, Metsu, Fairbanks, there are your challenges.
That's correct.
Right. So could you describe to me how you look to tackle that part of the challenge?
Well, I can use my investigator, and if this goes through, I probably would want to have another investigator. And we can use those investigators, particularly the retired state trooper, to reach those other police agencies in addition to the state troopers. But it is going to be very difficult. We have tried to go to most of those local agencies and speak to them. I know that my investigator has spoken to the Fairbanks Police Department, the Palmer and the Wasilla Police Departments, the Kenai Police Departments. He's traveling to Nome next week to talk to the Nome Police Departments. And so he's making an effort to go and talk to all of the local police agencies. But it still will be very difficult. And there may be some resistance to them giving us those reports. Right now, my authority is that they must give me the reports if I have a victim complaining. And if we were to move to a situation where they must give me the reports, all reports, there may be some resistance. Although, as Lauren pointed out, the changes in this bill have made it a lot easier for police agencies. They don't really have to do a lot. And asking them to fax two pages of a police report doesn't seem to me to be much. It's just a matter of them remembering to do it, I think.
Go ahead, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I have minor concern in that we don't end up having the image of an external, internal affairs organization that's an oversight committee for law enforcement. And I say that only because that's my gut instinct, that could be the reaction by some.
Mm-hmm.
And you, have you had that concern, or do you think that's unreasonable?
I did. However, I think the original bill was even more, was even worse, because we're talking about police standards, where an officer who bungles an investigation can lose certification and not even and cannot be a police officer. So that's a lot harsher than what I'm asking them to do.
And don't get me wrong, I mean, the task at hand is a good one. It's mm-hmm. a matter of, you know, how that is perceived in mutual directions of how we get to it, and it's according to whether you're the investigator or the investigatee. But anyway, I wish you well.
Thank you. Other questions for Marianne? Seeing none, at the moment. Thank you very much, Mary Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bundy, who did you have next? Mr. Guarnelli.
Mr. Guarnelli and Susan are here as well.
Welcome back, Mr. Guarnelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dean Guarnelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General and primary pothole filler for this committee. Yeah. I will say initially that I do appreciate the work of Senator Bundy's staff in helping this bill evolve through a variety of ideas and trying to get a workable program. And just, you know, by way of background as to how we got to this point, I think there was a concern with the original version that some sort of written standards could end up, you know, backfiring when a case ultimately gets prosecuted if any particular step along the way was omitted by the police. That becomes an item for the defense to use in challenging the police investigation. That was certainly a concern to us as prosecutors and to police agencies, particularly Department of Public Safety. I think that there was also a concern that subjecting officers to the authority of the Police Standards Council for, you know, violating those standards was something that in some way took away from the ability of the police agency itself to, you know, to govern its officers and to regulate their conduct. It was an outside agency imposing additional standards in circumstances where it wasn't even clear to a lot of the police agencies that there is any kind of systemic problem that needs to be addressed with those kinds of remedies. And so really to determine whether it's a systemic issue in Alaska or whether it's a matter of an individual officer having too much of a workload and that workload needing to be adjusted, or an individual officer needing additional training in sexual assault investigation and having the agency get that training for the officer. That initial determination, I think, you know, it needed to be made. And therefore, the idea of this the CS was to allow an agency that already has an existing structure set up for receiving complaints from crime victims to receive complaints that sexual assault investigations were not done quickly or completely, and to, through the usual investigatory means of that existing agency, through their existing procedures, to see if there was a problem, to see if there was an individual problem, to, under OVR's existing statutes, to work with the justice agencies involved, whether it be the troopers or a municipal police department, to make a recommendation to the chief of the police department whether that officer needed, you know, a workload reassignment, needed additional training, needed some sort of discipline, to, under their procedures, to even issue a public report if that is appropriate to, and this is beyond the report that's set out in here. The Office of Victims' Rights has statutory authority to issue reports otherwise. To try to put this issue, whether it's a problem or not, to be assessed and to allow the Office of Victims' Rights to use its existing authority and its existing procedures to assess that. And that's how we got to this point. To address a couple of the questions that the committee members raised, let me just start out with the applicability section and the essentially the effective date. It was my idea that there be that OVR be given authority to go back in time to offenses committed, you know, before the effective date of the act, to be able to assess that. But through talking with the legislative drafter, there was some question whether, you know, if you go back too far, then are you really assessing what the current situation is in Alaska? And that's really what this is designed. I mean, what is happening in Alaska generally right now. So if you go back too far, you tend to lose that sense of what's going on at present. For offenses committed before the effective date of the Act, the July 10, 2003 date was actually a suggestion by Mr. Luckoff, the legislative drafter, because before that date, the Office of Victims' Rights did not have jurisdiction over municipal law enforcement agencies. And after that date, there was a statutory amendment to give them that jurisdiction. And he felt, and I agreed with him, that was a reasonable date to pick to go back. You know, it goes back 3 years in the past. It goes to a point where municipal law enforcement agencies are also included under OVR's jurisdiction, and that seemed to be far enough to avoid working on a lot of old cases that don't give us a sense of what's currently going on at present. So that's the answer to that question. I guess in and let me say, I have a great deal of respect for Marion Henry. I've known her for 30 years. She and I both started with the Department of Law at the same time. We were the graduating class, law school graduating class of 1976, if you can believe it. We started together. I've worked with her over many, many years, and I respect her abilities and her integrity. So I think that OVR, under her leadership, is certainly going to be able to do a very good job in assessing whether there is a problem in dealing with specific agencies and reporting to the legislature. But the way the CS was drafted was to take advantage of OVR's existing procedures. And the existing procedures in statute and in the regulations is that OVR receives complaints from victims and investigates those complaints. And in doing so, has the authority to request agency records, to review those records, whether they're confidential or not, to review court records, prosecution records, law enforcement agency records, to work with the agencies and report to those agencies and to the public if necessary. That mechanism, that existing statutory mechanism, appears to work well. It's worked for a number of years. And I think that we may be going a bit far to, with this particular pilot program, in this particular instance, to have justice agencies affirmatively reporting to OVR allegations of rape and first-degree sexual abuse of a minor. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. And the primary one really is that victims have a right to confidentiality, and that's even a right to confidentiality to being reported to an agency of the legislature, which OVR is. There are victims' rights statutes which limit how much information the police can affirmatively give out about victims. Victims have, I think, not only statutory but constitutional rights, and as Marion Henry indicated, some of them want it all over and done with. Some of them want to forget about it. Some of them want to bring the issue to closure in their minds. And if that means not reporting it to the police in the first place, I think they have a right to do that. I think they should be certainly encouraged to do that by a system that is open and fair, and that where they think they will get a fair investigation. But if they choose not to, I think that is that's really their decision to make. And I think that if they decide to talk to the police and after talking with them, I think that if charges are not going to be filed for whatever reason, I think that they ought to have a right not to have their name reported to another outside agency, or the fact that their rape case was reported to the police. So I believe that their existing procedures work well, and I think will work in this case to determine if there's a problem. I believe if what is reported to OVR are a couple of anecdotal cases. I think they'll deal with them on a case-by-case basis, agency-by-agency basis. If in investigating those cases, it appears that for a particular agency or maybe for a system as a whole, there's a more systemic problem, I think OVR has, you know, broad statutory authority to seek records from agencies about the handling of those cases. But until we get to that point, it may be a bit premature to go that far. So I'm very comfortable with the CS as it exists. I've spoken directly with Commissioner Tandesky, who had expressed concerns about the original version of the bill, and he is he's certainly satisfied with the bill as it exists, and we support the effort to look into this matter and determine whether there is a widespread problem. So with that initial statement, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Quinelli. Is there any standard information that's provided to a victim by an investigatory agency regarding services that are provided by OVR?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. One of the current existing statutory rights of crime victims is the right to be notified orally and in writing and receive information about the Office of Victims' Rights from the law enforcement officer initially investigating the crime, and that includes, at a minimum, address, telephone number, internet address of the Office of Victims' Rights. And I believe when this particular provision was enacted in the Victims' Rights statutes, this is probably goes back two or three or four years ago, we actually went to the Office of Victims' Rights at the time and said, you know, what do you want us to provide? You know, give us the, you know, a little card or brochure or what you want. And I'm not exactly sure what is given out now. It may vary agency to agency, but there is that information, at least, of the existence of the office and how to contact them.
I seem to remember that conversation in this committee. Is that, don't you, Senator Frank?
Mm-hmm.
On how we were trying to make sure that a victim knew that they had certain assistance available through the Office of Victim Rights. I'm just wondering, you know, since we're in this pilot project, this pilot program that we're looking at here, I'd be just curious to see what information is provided to a victim. See whether in that there's information there that would say, you know, if you feel that the case is not being investigated in a timely manner, you have the ability to talk with the people at OVR or something along that line. I'm just curious that the amount of information, the content of information that's provided, maybe we could get a copy of that. Marianne?
Yes.
Stay there if you would, Dean. If you'll put yourself back on the record for us, Marianne.
All right. For the record, my name is Marianne Henry, Director of the Office of Victims' Rights. There is a pamphlet. It's three-sided, six pages, basically, that explains the Office of Victims' Rights. However, my predecessor made it pretty complicated, and I've been trying to do something to make it a one-page, very simple, simple to read for victims, because it sets forth a lot of the laws and things like that the victims really don't need to know.
Right.
And they, in Juneau, actually, the DA's office is sending out postcards on. And they say there's one side that talks about Office of Victims' Rights and another part that talks about the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. The problem is that they send those out after they've gotten the cases. But what I've found is when the police officer gives the victim this pamphlet, the victim is usually at such a stage of emotional distress that they don't even realize what they're getting. And it disappears. Because a lot of times, you know, when I've talked to victims before I was with the Office of Victims' Rights, and I would ask them, well, why, you know, why didn't you go there? They didn't even know what I was talking about. and I knew they had probably gotten the pamphlet. So that's the concern. Now, if we simplified the pamphlet, that might help. But again, at the time the officers are contacting them, I'm not sure they're really paying much attention to what they're getting.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Gass.
Yes, I actually had a question that maybe one or both of you guys can answer. And it, receiving a complaint from a victim, I guess one of the concerns I have, and I'm not familiar with the current statute, is how children or those who are mentally challenged or disabled are handled, and whether or not you have to have a complaint currently from the victim, and how children and those that might be under the guardian of someone else are handled, and then how would they be handled in this bill?
It's the legal guardian or the parent would file the complaint.
So and that would be the current in this. We don't have to have the child making the complaint. The legal guardian can, and that's already established.
That's my understanding. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dean.
Senator Guest, through the chair, the definition of victim, the operative definition of victim for a child victim includes the victim's parent, and for a deceased victim it includes a member of the victim's immediate family. And I mean there's a detailed definition of victim which takes into account those kinds of situations.
Okay, thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Senator. Who was your next testifier? Senator Bundy?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I believe that completes our testimony. I would just share a couple of thoughts. I certainly understand and appreciate the reaching out to victims to allow them or encourage them, perhaps inform them of the avenue that they have available to them. A group that we've overlooked so far are the advocacy groups like STAR and Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. But again, the victim has to make the first step, but if indeed they are involved in that process, they're also then counseled about their rights as victims and the Office of Victims' Rights and what can be done for them. So, in looking at both sides of the coin, I'd like to quote Commissioner of Public Safety. He says, "You can't legislate give a damn." And when I wanted to make some very serious standards, that applied. And with the challenge that we have of dealing with, and I can only imagine what the emotional challenges must be of someone who's a victim of sexual assault, they also have to want to participate, and there may indeed be denial may be their best defense mechanism at the time, and we while I wouldn't encourage that, we can't take that away from them either. So on both sides of the issue, we have to legislate a tool for those who do give a damn and want to do something.
Okay. Other questions for the sponsor? Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bundy, there has been some discussion here today about what your intent was. And given this is a whole new rewrite of the bill, we actually don't have that anywhere in writing. It seems as if the bill, which I fully support, says, okay, we're going to have this pilot program which looks at these cases that have fallen through the cracks. It's not supposed to try to get the best statistics in the state, but has somewhere for victims to go. Or was it to try to figure out where the disconnect is between 100 cases getting reported but only 10 being prosecuted?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Guest, my intent, I think, was probably in multiple intents. It's important to have the data, of course. I think the intent is to push departments that need encouragement toward more professionalism in investigating sexual assault. It is to give the victim some comfort that they still have recourse. They have somebody to talk to, that it's not as nameless bureaucracy that they have no access to or won't get their phone calls answered and that sort of thing. So my goal is multiple. It isn't just to gather information. It's to give the victim, I said, some hope, and to give encouragement to departments. Those that are doing a good job can always learn and do better, and those that aren't doing a very good job certainly need to learn to do a better job. And when perhaps OVR shining a light on a problem that may is certainly don't assume to be an intentional dereliction, but something that isn't being done, and maybe they have to come back to us then and say we need more cert kits or more training. But it's just shining the bright light.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Bundy, so is it your intent that that the current CS is how you would like to see the bill proceed forward? Or would your intent be to expand any more oversight or authority or to OVR?
I think this is a an adequate compromise, and we ought to go with the possible. Should there be a need to expand this authority, I'd be interested in doing that in another piece of legislation as we become more experienced.
Okay. Is there other discussion or questions? I don't have anyone signed up locally to testify or anyone else offline. So is there? Nope. So we'll close public testimony on the bill, open the bill for discussion among the members. If there's no discussion among the members, is there a will of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest.
I'll move CS for Senate Bill 134 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached new fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved to its next committee referral. Thank you very much, Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, and my sincere wishes, I don't have an opportunity to come back before you on sexual assault.
Not this year, at least. With that, we'll take a short recess to get our paperwork, and then we'll move on to our next, which is Representative Roachberg. back on the record. Welcome, Representative Rokeberg, to the committee this morning, and we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. It's always a pleasure to be back before the Senate Judiciary Committee and its members. I'm Norman Rokeberg, representative from South Spinard, Sand Lake, and Fire Island in Anchorage. And I'm here to present House Bill 441 on the therapeutic courts or wellness court issue. Mr. Chairman, there is a committee substitute, version I presented for the committee's purview. It has some minor technical corrections.
If you okay. We have before us version I, India, of the bill. Chair would entertain a motion to adopt this as our working document. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee consider the backslash I version as a working document before the committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Representative Rokeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does, it basically is a culmination of several years' effort by the legislature and legislators within our body to move forward and fund and organize the therapeutic court or wellness court model in the state of Alaska. We have over the years passed different pieces of legislation, including establishing a pilot program with courts, felony DUI courts in Bethel and in Anchorage. And this bill, among other things, does finally recognize them and removes any sunset provisions there. Those positions and those costs have been absorbed into the budget from before and other lead pieces of legislation, so this bill has a zero fiscal note. But it brings together and streamlines the slightly distinct district court and superior court applications of the mitigating factors that allowed discretion amongst the judges to met out the and use the model of the therapeutic court. And I don't think I need to go into any further detail. The members of this committee and jointly with the House committee had a presentation from what I call the OSBSers, which is the outside big shots that were here in town recently, explaining the efficacy and the success of this model throughout the country. Alaska's been on the leading edge, led by Judge James Wanamaker, recently retired, who basically on his own was able to introduce this model into the Anchorage Wellness Court and work quite successfully. We've had some difficulties, Mr. Chairman, with the breaking through the cultural barriers of the Department of Corrections and, in some instances, the Department of Law to get them to take up this particular idea. We still remain working on that, and I think we've made some substantial progress. And too bad Senator Bundy isn't here, but just by way of recognizing some of the benefits, for example, of passing the seatbelt bill, the Alaska Highway Safety Office was able to make substantial awards and grants as a result of that directly to the program with the state match. I believe there was $679,000 of federal money to be matched with $344,000 for a total of $1 million to establish new wellness courts in the state and support some of the existing ones. Among them, Mr. Chairman, are probably one near and dear to your heart in the Fairbanks area. As much as $177,000 will be directed at establishing a new wellness court in that area. And also in Ketchikan, which shares with Juneau PD and DA assistance for the grand total of $271,000 to establish a new Ketchikan court and to build on the basis of Judge Frelich's commencement several years ago here in Juneau. So with that, we'll have courts in Ketchikan, Fairbanks, two different levels in Anchorage, as well as the other drug courts and mental health courts there in Bethel and in Juneau. So, Mr. Chairman, I want to compliment my staff, Heather Nabagra, the counsel in my office, working with the Deputy Attorney General and Ms. Parks and Doug Woolver, the court system, to work together to blend the statutes. It was good deal more difficult than one would suspect. I was rather surprised. But I think they've done a marvelous job of bringing this bill before the legislature, which streamlining costs nothing and makes a step forward to one program. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, that the legislature can take pride in. There's much as a 10-to-1 savings here. For each dollar we invest, we can save actual cash dollars and our costs of having to deal with these people that themselves are self-created victims, if you will. But I think the most important thing, Mr. Chairman, is we've turned the lives around for some people. Because this intense program, not just therapy or treatment, but a combination of different elements that work in this model, we've actually saved people's lives and brought them back into as effective citizens in our community. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator Guest.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. Page 3, lines 11 through 13. Talks about a court may not elect to proceed under the section if the defendant has previously participated in a court-ordered treatment program under the section for two or more times, and has a definition of court-ordered treatment before. Am I correct in reading the bill right in that if they've been to therapeutic court two or more times, they can't participate, or are there other court-ordered therapies that maybe they did 5 years ago or 10 years ago that would count towards this two times?
Well, through the chair, Senator Guest, it's my intent there that they would only be under the therapeutic court model.
Okay.
So if they've been given the chance to return and they've messed up, then there's going to be an end to it. They won't be allowed back into it.
But it's not the way, and I don't know enough about the treatment programs to understand that.
No, it doesn't go in the broad spectrum. It's only within the concept of the wellness group.
Okay. And am I reading it correctly that if they started therapeutic courts but dropped out, then that would count? That's the intent.
I'm getting a yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator French?
Just a follow-up on that question and then a separate one. Because I think Senator Guest makes a good point. Why wouldn't, and Ron Taylor's on the line, maybe this is a question better for Mr. Taylor, who runs the Anchorage ASAP program. Why wouldn't ASAP, the Alaska, he'll have to remind me what the initials stand for, but it's basically alcohol treatment for DWI offenders, why wouldn't that count as a court-ordered treatment program? And why wouldn't that create a problem? Because a lot of times the folks we send to therapeutic court have got 6 or 7 prior DWIs. They've been sent to ASAP numerous times and by the de facto flunked out because of the fact that they're back. So maybe that's a question for Mr. Taylor.
Yeah, we do have the attorney, Deputy Attorney General and Mr. Wolver here. I would prefer to defer those questions.
Whoever feels best qualified to answer that.
It'd be better, more timely, if the committee's time to do that way.
We can do that. Mr. Wolver, if you want to come up. Thank you very much, Representative Roseberg. Welcome back, Mr. Wolver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Wolver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. As you know, my standard line is the court doesn't take a position for or against legislation. This is one of those times I get to violate that standard rule. This is a bill we support, proud to support it. In answer to your question, Senator French, that language refers to a court-ordered treatment program under this section, and this section is the new section 28, which is limited to the therapeutic courts. So other failed attempts, and you're right, most of these people have been through numerous failed attempts at treatment, but it's under this section that the limit is.
That's the excellent legal answer. Next question refers to page 4, section C, and it really has to do with integrating. It's more general, but I think it's highlighted by this section. It's integrating this bill with the bill that came through this committee earlier this year, the no bail for convicts bill, the bill that says that once you've been moved over to the Department of Corrections, you're no longer eligible for bail, or at least a judge can no longer set bail for you. And I guess I'm just wanting to make sure we don't create a conflict between this good idea and that good idea, where we have maybe an aggressive DA in some part of the state, DAs are skeptical, or at least I was skeptical of this program. I've been won over, but there's some folks I'm sure who are still a little bit skeptical about this therapeutic court idea, and they may take an aggressive view of the no bail bill and say, this person's been convicted, this person's entered a no judgment, no contest plea, this person is no longer subject to setting a bail by the court. This person's now in the hands of the Department of Corrections. So I guess I'm asking whether this section C doesn't, by referring to the defendant's no contest or guilty plea, doesn't set up some conflict, if you will, between this bill and the no bail bill we passed earlier this year out of this committee.
To the Chair, Senator French, I don't believe that there is a conflict. It would be a problem if there was. I don't think there is. Subsection C refers to those who fail the program. And the program is, if you complete the program, you're entitled to these sentencing benefits as under your plea agreement, your Rule 11 agreement. If you fail, then this subsection 6C kicks in, and you're subject to whatever the plea was. You've already pled guilty to the crime, so you're now out of the program, and this is the consequence of failure. And it's not part of the post-sentence or the pre-sentencing provision. Now you've been sentenced and you're in jail.
But just to be clear, you have entered a no contest plea. You have pled guilty to the offense. And so I guess I'm curious about where in the no bail bill we take away the court's ability to monitor, if you will, the conditions of release of the defendant, because that's exactly what's happening here. We're saying you're released to a court-ordered therapeutic program and not to the Department of Corrections.
To the Chair, Senator French, maybe
Ms. Parks
can help with this.
We haven't heard from
as well
today, and we want to hear from her. So.
But my understanding is you are entitled to bail because this isn't the bail bill says if you cannot meet the conditions of your bail, you stay in jail. The judge can then waive that temporarily to allow you to attend something, and then you go back to jail. But you have not met the conditions of your bail. In this case, you are meeting the conditions of your bail. The conditions of your bail are continued participation in the program. So it's my understanding is it's different, but maybe.
Just so my question's clear, I thought we drew a fairly bright line between pre-conviction and post-conviction bail release. And since these therapeutic court attendees are post-conviction, they pled no contest, that's the bright line I'm concerned about.
Ms. Parks, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I'm in agreement with Mr. Wolliver's analysis. I don't believe there is a conflict. The bail bill that you're referring to talked about temporary releases, and I don't consider a judge who sets bail at being released for purposes of a treatment program, that's not a temporary, it's not a, you're out for 48 hours. I mean, this is your bail conditions, you've met bail and you're out. Now, once the person bails out of the treatment program, you're probably going to be remanded. New bail would be set, but I don't believe, because this is an 18-month program, and so when bail is set to allow you to participate in the therapeutic court program, it's not a temporary bail setting, it is your bail for purposes of that conviction pre-sentencing while you're released.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Wolliver or Ms. Parks? Mr. Wolliver, the court system's all set to get this underway?
Mr. Chairman, as you know, it is underway in many parts of the state. We're continuing to develop, as we spoke this morning, on Fairbanks model. The Anchorage model, the Anchorage felony court is not operating right now, but this bill resolves one of the concerns that that office has about equal protection issues for it's available in some areas and not in others. This bill resolves that by making the provisions available statewide. We anticipate that court to be up and running again as soon as this bill is signed into law. The felony drug court in Anchorage is back up and running again. So. Everything hopefully just continues on. The other programs are running fine, and this bill allows them to continue.
Other questions?
Senator French?
I'm just asking this out of an abundance of caution, because every now and then in these bills, there's a change in the look-back provisions, and that creates a little flurry of activity amongst the residents of one of my districts, which is Spinard. And so I just want to know whether we're changing any DWI look-back provisions in this bill.
No, Senator French, we are not.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Roekberg, we, in this committee, since you're from the southern part of Sand Lake, we give you a certain limit. Yeah, it goes back to a skit that was earlier presented. But any other questions from members on the bill? I am in full support of the bill. I think, you know, it's a worthwhile effort. We need to see just what we can do, because alcohol abuses and other drug abuses are such a huge cost to the state, both in money and in terms of its social impact, that this is, I believe, a very worthwhile project. And hopefully we can, from this, be able to not only save the state money and time, but to help people address problems on a social level that have huge impact on the people of the state. So I'm very hopeful that this will go forward and be very successful. Do we have any other questions? Do you have any questions, Senator Huggins, that you will have on this particular bill?
I know I've read it. I'm comfortable with it.
Okay. Do we have anybody else that wants to testify on the bill? We do have some of it for answers or questions, but no one that's indicated they wanted to testify. Anyone in Juneau? Anyone online?
We have Anchorage. People in
Anchorage indicated yes for questions. Ronald Taylor and Janet McCabe. Not having any questions for those folks, we'll close public testimony on the bill and open the bill for discussion among the members. Senator Guest?
Ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
I'll move. Just making sure I have the right one. Senate CS for CS House Bill 441 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. And then I'll make a second motion for the concurrence.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion for the passing the Senate out of the CS out of committee? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Guest?
Mr. Chair, I will move the Senate concurrent resolution, which goes to House Bill 441, title change, out of committee.
Okay, there is a motion to move the Senate concurrent resolution on the title change, along with the bill to the Senate. And is there objection to that? Hearing no objection, it's adopted. This bill, along with the concurrent resolution, proceed next to the next committee of referral. Let's take a short recess. back on the record. Is there anything else that needs to come before the committee today? Hearing none, there is no committee meeting tomorrow. There is no committee meeting on Tuesday morning. Our next committee meeting will be next Wednesday morning at 8:30. And with that, the committee is adjourned until next Wednesday morning.